It's 9 o'clock on a Thursday night, and it's time for the Earth First Update, all the environmental news you can use. And we're going to start off with some announcements here. Join us in recognition of Judy Berry Day this coming Sunday, May 24th, 19 years ago. Hard to believe it was 19 years ago on May 24th, 1990, that a pipe bomb planted under her car seat exploded and nearly killed Judy Berry. And only hours later, she was charged with bombing herself along with her comrade in the car, Daryl Cherney. It was 12 years ago that Judy, after fighting the FBI, fighting for the forests and the workers, and putting together a constitutional rights lawsuit against the FBI and the Oakland cops, tragically died of cancer at her home. And it was 7 years ago that that lawsuit that she worked so hard on finally came to federal court, and they won in a historical decision challenging COINTELPRO and the FBI's dirty tricks. And it was a year later that the city of Oakland declared May 24th Judy Berry Day. And every year since 1990, we remember that warrior woman, remember to never give up the fight, and to make sure we never forget that day and understand what the state is capable of when it has no regard for people's rights or Mother Earth. We also celebrate the phenomenal legal victory that our amazing legal team won against the FBI in 2002. We have had rallies at the Oakland Federal Building, have commemorated the day in many other cities, and have held events at the site of the 1990 bomb explosion. This year, on Sunday, May 24th, people will gather at 11:30 in the morning at the intersection of Park Boulevard and East 33rd, near the 580 and MacArthur Boulevard in Oakland. This is where the bomb exploded, and a few minutes after noon, and at that time, there will be a moment of silence. But the rest of the time, the people will not be silent. Bring music, your thoughts about Judy, your words about the FBI's trampling of activist rights. And look for the colorful banner that says, "Don't ever give up." Here in Santa Cruz, this Saturday is going to be the Sea Cliff Beach Upper Bluff Native Plant Restoration Project. We had a modest but very helpful turnout at our first Saturday of the month weeding party to eradicate the invasive wild radish. We pulled hundreds of these noxious plants, but hundreds remain. This is one scary plant that will grow up to 3 feet tall and obscure the existence of 3,000 living newly planted native plants and grasses. Also, the many radish flowers will go to seed soon, scattering more seeds for next season. So please come out this Saturday morning, May 23rd at 9 a.m. till noon. Wear a hat and gardening gloves. Bring your trowel, clippers, or any other weeding implement and knee pads or other knee protection. I'll bring 3 long-handled weeding tools for those who can't kneel. And this event is only canceled for pouring rain. No likely chance of that. The host will also bring water, juice, and nourishing snacks. Please come and help save our California native plants. Please let me know if you can attend for any period of time. Thank you sincerely, Terry Winston, and his telephone number 251-0001. Once again, that's Terry at 251-0001. And again, that's going to be at the Sea Cliff Beach Upper Bluff Native Plant Restoration Project this Saturday, May 23rd at 9 a.m. And greetings, volunteers. The time has come again for a broom pulling party in Lompico, and that's French broom for those of you who don't know what the broom pulling party is. As most of you know, teams of volunteers have been working on this removal effort since 2006. French broom is a highly invasive and difficult to remove species. The past removal parties have done an amazing job of removing the larger plants that once dominated the southern part of the Lompico Headwaters property. Now we just need to ensure that these smaller plants do not reproliferate. This year's work party will be held on Saturday, May 30th. That's a week from now. And we will be meeting that day at 9:30 at the Mountain Roastings Coffee Shop in Felton, and then carpool to the work area from there. I believe Mountain Roastings Coffee Shop is next to the Slave Way. We expect to be finished around 3. If you... If you can't make it to the Mountain Roastings Coffee Shop in Felton for the carpool at 9:30, then just go to the end of La Pico Road, walk up past the gate, which probably might even be open, and tell them you're there to pull broom. Ken Moore, an expert on invasive species management, will be leading the effort. At the beginning of the day, Ken will provide the necessary training on the hows and whys of French broom removal. This is a great opportunity to learn from the expert in the field, hang out with fellow Semper Virens supporters, and directly benefit our local environment. Volunteers should bring work gloves and a lunch. We will provide water and other refreshments, all necessary tools, fun, and frivolity. And if you can, please send an RSVP to kbuelterman@sempervirens.org, and I will spell that. That's kbuelterman at sempervirens.org. SEMPERVIRENS. Or, if you can't manage that email, it's 650-968-4509. 650-968-4509. And once again, that's Saturday, May 30th, a little over a week from now, 9:30 for carpooling at the Mountain Roastings Coffee Shop in Felton. And otherwise, go to the end of La Pico Road. Now it's time for the Buffalo Field Campaign update from the field for this week. The Montana Department of Livestock and Yellowstone National Park continue to aggressively haze any wild bison in Montana. Just a few miles from here on Cattle Free Horse Butte and other areas of the Gallatin National Forest, the buffalo are currently under attack by livestock interests. Buffalo Field Campaign patrols are with the buffalo, documenting all the actions made against them. The scenes we've been witnessing this week are the stuff of nightmares. Within a single week, at least four newborn buffalo have suffered broken legs or debilitating leg injuries as a result of government hazing activities. All these injuries have been documented by Buffalo Field Campaign. Unfortunately, during today's hazing operation, another mother and calf were separated, and patrols are currently monitoring the mother as she searches for her lost baby. On Friday, the Montana Department of Livestock chased all of the bull bison that had been grazing in the Duck Creek area deep into Yellowstone National Park. By Monday, 11 bulls had returned to their chosen ground, and the Montana Department of Livestock resumed their harassment operations, forcing them back into Yellowstone, right through the middle of the park's grizzly bear closure area. What's more, there's no cattle currently grazing in that area. Furthermore, the adaptive management plan states that bull bison are allowed to be within Zone 2 lands year-round, an area approximately 5 miles west of Yellowstone's boundary. These bulls are in their favorite Duck Creek migration corridor, which, while still within the so-called tolerance zone, the agency's adaptive plan deems off-limits to them, wantonly setting the buffalo up to fail. On Tuesday, Montana Department of Livestock, National Park Service, Montana Fish, Wildlife, and Parks horsemen began the day by chasing two moms and two baby buffalo off of the Gallatin National Forest for a few miles through the thick woods. Then they picked up another 30 buffalo, including more newborns, and proceeded to chase them out of this area and into Yellowstone. On Wednesday, agents returned again to this cattle-free area, this public lands buffalo habitat, to haze yet another group of mixed buffalo, including three newborns. During yesterday's haze, another two moms and two babies eluded the Montana Department of Livestock for the remainder of the day, though the agents tried numerous times to find and harass them. Today, the agents are back harassing buffalo within Gallatin National Forest on Horse Butte and the south side of the Madison River. The hazing will not stop at Yellowstone's border, but will continue deep into the park. Patrols have called in two more reports of calves whose legs have been injured during hazing activities. That's four calves in 1 week, and these are just the ones we know of. Likely, there have been many more injuries to newborns, yearlings, and adults. Furthermore, agents are running the buffalo for miles without allowing them to stop for water, nor allowing calves to stop for nursing. By the end of the day, these buffalo will have been chased nearly 20 miles. There will never be cattle in this area, yet livestock interests continue to deny the buffalo access to their native habitat, America's public lands, and the private lands where buffalo are welcome. Buffalo will never surrender their ancient migratory instincts to arbitrary human boundaries, fences, or timelines, We, the people, must continue to stand with the buffalo and force the agencies to abandon their arrogant and senseless actions against wild bison. Cattle aren't present on public lands in this region, yet millions of federal tax dollars continue to be squandered to placate the livestock industry's economic interests. History is doomed to repeat itself if we don't act. Please continue to write to President Barack Obama and your members of Congress and the decision makers involved in this absurd management scheme. We must keep the pressure applied for as long as it takes to set the buffalo free. For more information, visit the Buffalo Field Campaign website at www.buffalofieldcampaign.org and be sure to check out what their needs are in terms of equipment or money. And they're probably going to start looking for volunteers for their summer program in the parks. So check that out. If there's something that you can send to the Buffalo Field Campaign, either time, money, or materials, send it to Buffalo Field Campaign, P.O. Box 957, West Yellowstone, Montana, 59758. That address, once again, the Buffalo Field Campaign, P.O. Box 957, West Yellowstone, Montana, 59758. And before you visit the Buffalo Field Campaign, be sure to give them a call, area code 406-646-0070. They'd love to hear from volunteers before they arrive. And remember, the Buffalo Field Campaign is the only group working in the field every day in defense of the last wild buffalo population in the United States. And a legal victory for marine wildlife has been threatened by oil drilling. In another major victory for conservation interests, an appeals court has struck down the Bush administration's controversial five-year plan for offshore drilling, which would have opened millions of acres off the Alaskan coast to provide critical habitat for polar bears, walruses, and millions of migratory birds to drilling. The U.S. Court of Appeals in Washington, D.C. told the Interior Department to rewrite the entire 2007 through 2012 plan for offshore drilling, finding that the government's environmental sensitivity rankings were irrational. The decision means that four proposed lease sales in the Arctic Ocean and one in Bristol Bay will no longer be allowed to go forward. Just one oil spill in the Arctic Ocean, particularly in the Beaufort or Chukchi Seas, could be devastating to wildlife that inhabit the area, including a tenth of the world's polar bears, as well as walrus, seal, whales, and migratory birds. And the Gulf of Mexico fishery has been shut down for sea turtles. Responding to an April suit by the Center for Biological Diversity and their allies, the National Marine Fisheries Service ordered a six-month emergency closure of the Gulf of Mexico's bottom longline fishery to halt the sea turtle slaughter. When sea turtles get tangled among the hundreds or even thousands of baited hooks used by longline fishing vessels, they sustain life-threatening injuries. If they don't drown while caught in the hooks, turtles are unable to snap out of the extreme psychological stress of capture and die immediately after release. According to the service's data, fishery vessels in the Gulf caught nearly 1,000 sea turtles, including about 800 federally protected loggerhead seal turtles, between July 2006 and December 2008, nearly eight times the agency itself deemed permissible. Now the fishery will be closed for 180 days, beginning on May 16th, to allow for a new evaluation of the fishery's impacts and to ensure that it's not likely to endanger the existence of sea turtle species. This temporary closure gives sea turtles a much-needed reprieve and gives the agency time to make scientifically sound decisions regarding the long-term operation of the fisheries, said Center Attorney Andrea Treis. More sea turtles will now have a chance to make it back to their nesting beaches and even just look for food without getting caught up in long lines. And gray wolves have lost their protections, and a suit is brewing over imminent wolf slaughter. The Fed's April 2nd rule went into effect to prematurely remove federal protections for gray wolves in the Northern Rockies, Great Lakes region, and other areas. The rule temporarily put on hold while President Barack Obama came on the scene is a follow-through on a Bush administration plan to increase federal and private wolf hunting. Idaho plans to kill hundreds of wolves, many of which will be brutally gunned down from the air, while Great Lakes states will allow the killing of significant numbers of wolves even as disease is killing their pups. Wolves in Wyoming are the only ones that will keep their federal safeguards because Wyoming refused to provide the minimal state protections other states had promised, which are still grossly inadequate. But besides affecting wolves in the northern Rockies and western Great Lakes, the rule also undermines wolf recovery in a third of eastern Oregon and eastern Washington, as well as a portion of northern Utah, though wolf presence in those regions is barely budding. As Center Wolf expert Michael Robinson asserts, we fear that once again wolves will be wantonly slaughtered before a court can rule. And thousands of caves have been closed in 33 states to protect bats. More than a year after the Center for Biological Diversity and Heartwood petitioned to protect endangered bats in the face of deadly white nose syndrome, specifically to close off caves and other spots where the flying mammals hibernate, the Forest Service has announced it will close to the public all caves and abandon mines on agency lands across the Midwest, New England, and its southern region in 33 states total. The move is an attempt to stop the spread of white nose syndrome, a mysterious disease that has killed 500,000 to a million bats, including endangered Indiana bats, since it was first discovered fewer than 3 years ago in New York. The Forest Service's move comes just weeks after the disease popped up for the first time in Virginia. Says Molly Madison, the center's premier bat advocate, the closures are the right thing to do, but we wish the Forest Service had done this last year. White nose syndrome demonstrated its horrible lethality from the get-go. In the face of such a threat, responsible agencies need to be proactive in protecting species, not just waiting until the disease is on their doorstep. And Obama adopts Bush's polar bear extinction plan. In a supremely disappointing and for polar bears life-threatening move, Interior Secretary Ken Salazar announced he would endorse a Bush policy condemning the polar bear to extinction instead of rescinding the rule as requested by Congress. Salazar ignored hundreds of thousands of citizen petitions, more than 94,000 of them from the Center for Biological Diversity supporters, plus letters from scores of lawmakers, 44 law professors, and more than 130 conservation organizations, and more than 1,300 prominent scientists. The rule specifically exempts greenhouse gas emissions from Endangered Species Act review, even though global warming is driving the polar bear extinct. Salazar's decision is a gift to big oil, declared the center's biodiversity program director Noah Greenwald. We're already fighting in court the bad polar bear rule and will soon press for an injunction to bar its use. And the warmth-threatened pika hops toward protection. In response to a 2007 petition and a 2008 lawsuit by the Center for Biological Diversity last Wednesday, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service announced the kickoff of a full review of the American pika's plight to determine whether it deserves protection under the Endangered Species Act, and it definitely does. The pika, a small alpine-dwelling rabbit relative living in the western United States, is seriously threatened by global warming because it's adapted to cold mountain climates and can die when exposed to temperatures as low as 78 degrees for mere hours. Global warming also reduces pika's food availability, shortens the time they can gather food, and reduces the snowpack they need in winter for insulation. Thankfully, the administration must now decide on Endangered Species Act protections to the pika by February of next year. The creature is the first mammal in the lower 48 states to be considered for protection under global warming under the act. In more good pika news, last month a judge agreed with a center lawsuit against the California Fish and Game Commission, declaring the commission was wrong when it rejected our petition to protect the pika under the state's own Endangered Species Act. And I think we're going to have more news about that in just a minute. And the salamander earns a fresh chance at protected habitat. Thanks to a Center for Biological Diversity lawsuit last week, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service agreed to reconsider a heinous Bush-era decision eliminating habitat protections for the Sonoma County population of the California tiger salamander, a charming but seriously imperiled Golden State amphibian. In 2005, the administration overruled agency scientists who had originally proposed federal protection for 74,000 acres of salamander habitat instead, under the direction of corrupt former Interior official Julie McDonald, granting the salamander a whopping 0 acres. Our suit to earn the salamander the protection it needs is part of a larger campaign to overturn all politically tainted Bush administration decisions that affected 59 species and more than 8 million acres of critical habitat. And the condor shooting investigation continues. You can help with the investigation in full swing to find the person or people who shot two endangered California condors full of lead bullets in March. The Center for Biological Diversity and Bruce Robertson, our private eye on the case, have produced a wanted poster to help with apprehension efforts, and it's posted here in the Free Radio studio. Both condors, one of which was found shot with three lead bullets and the other, which was full of 15, are still alive but may never return to the wild, where every last California condor is crucial. In addition to hiring an investigator, the center announced in mid-April that the reward fund for help in capturing the shooter or shooters has increased to $40,500, thanks to generous pledges made by several groups, including the Center for Biological Diversity, the Wendy P. McGraw Foundation, and the Humane Society. Lead bullets are the leading cause of death for the endangered condor, not just from shooting. Many condors die from lead poisoning after scavenging game shot with lead ammo. Just this week, condor number 236, one of the first six condors released in the wild in 2003 at Pinnacles National Monument, died of lead poisoning. Let's see here. And continuing with biological diversity news, California has been ordered to reconsider global warming threats to the pika. In response to a suit brought by the Center for Biological Diversity, represented by Earth Justice, a federal judge last week sent the California Fish and Game Commission back to the drawing board on its assessment of the plight of the American pika, a tiny mammal threatened by climate change. In 2007, we petitioned the commission to protect the pika under the state's Endangered Species Act, and after it rejected our petition, we filed suit the next year. Last Friday, a judge issued a written order to the commission invalidating its rejection of our petition and ordering it to think again about protecting the poor pika. Thanks to our efforts at the federal level, the species is already on its way towards protection under the U.S. Endangered Species Act. The American pika, adapted for the cold climate of mountain peaks in the U.S. West, is directly endangered by global warming because it can die when exposed to temperatures as low as 78 degrees Fahrenheit for just a few hours. Climate change exposes pikas to summer heat stress, lowers food availability, reduces food gathering time, and decreases snowpack they need for winter insulation. And the Pacific walrus moves toward protection. The polar bear is still floundering. This Monday, the tusk, blubbery, and highly imperiled Pacific walrus moved closer to Endangered Species Act protection when a federal judge approved a settlement between the Center for Biological Diversity and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, compelling the agency to decide on protections for the species. The Pacific walrus, whose scientific name translates to amusing tooth-walking seahorse, is not so entertainingly in danger as global warming melts the Arctic ice it needs for resting, breeding, raising young, and foraging activities. The center petitioned to protect the pinniped on February of 2008 and sued in December to force a response. Now the feds must voice their first thoughts on protection this September and issue a final decision next year. Even while the Pacific walrus's icy abode across its range is melting away, its habitat in the Chukchi Sea is being auctioned off to oil companies seeking to extract fossil fuels to further accelerate global warming and the melting of the Arctic, imperiling not just the walrus but also the polar bear, ice seals, and other species. Interior Secretary Ken Salazar is deciding how to deal with lawsuits, including one from the Center for Biological Diversity opposing Arctic oil drilling, but things aren't looking good considering his recent refusal to reverse the Bush administration's rule sharply limiting protections for the polar bear. Unfortunately for the walrus, the polar bear, and the entire Arctic ecosystem, Secretary Salazar seems more inclined to protect big oil than America's imperiled wildlife, said Center's Rebecca Noblin. And 60 groups tell Congress to work harder for bats. This Wednesday, the Center for Biological Diversity and a long list of other national and regional organizations sent a letter to members of Congress requesting increased funding for research on white nose syndrome, and a mysterious, fast-spreading, and fatal disease that has been affecting bats across the eastern United States. Since the disease first popped up 2 years ago near Albany, New York, An estimated 1 million-plus bats have fallen victim, including the federally protected Indiana bat. Biologists are concerned the disease may next strike endangered Virginia big-eared and gray bats, both of which have very limited ranges and cannot afford any more losses. Thankfully, after the Center for Biological Diversity in Hartwood petitioned to close off bat hibernation sites to help prevent the disease's spread, this spring the U.S. Forest Service announced it would close thousands of caves and abandoned mines on agency lands in 33 states in New England, New Midwest, and its southern region. But much more needs doing, and bats are dying every day. Federal and state agencies must have more dollars to fund research, coordination, and management to understand, fight, and hopefully overcome white nose syndrome so endangered bats don't die out forever. And the California Department of Food and, California Department of Fish and Game is using state-of-the-art technology to tag and track salmon. The California Department of Fish and Game is employing new computerized technology to track 8 million baby Fall Run Chinook salmon raised in Central Valley hatcheries. Information from coded wire tags implanted in the young fish will help fisheries managers make decisions regarding California's multi-million dollar commercial and sport salmon fishery. This marking and tagging process is currently underway at the Nimbus Salmon Hatchery in Rancho Cordova. We are pleased to see this important project is underway to produce strategic information on Central Valley salmon, said Department of Fish and Game State Fisheries Manager Neil Mangi. This collaborative project will yield critical data for improving the long-term management of Fall Run Chinook salmon in the Central Valley. Information on salmon survival and return is critical to salmon managers as they seek to stop the depletion of Central Valley Fall Run Chinook salmon stocks. This year's salmon fishing closures on Central Valley salmon stocks will cost California an estimated $279 million in lost revenue and 2,690 jobs. This year, Department of Fish and Game is using four state-of-the-art autofish system processing trailers that can mark and tag up to 350,000 young salmon in a day. The cooperative program is spearheaded by Department of Fish and Game and includes the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and the Pacific States Marine Fisheries Commission. The CalFed Ecosystem Restoration Program provided more than $6.7 million for initial equipment purchases and the first 2 years of project operations in 2007 and 2008. Beginning this year, operational costs of the program are funded by hatchery mitigation agencies, the U.S. Bureau of Reclamation, the California Department of Water Resources, and the East Bay Municipal Utilities District. The new tagging program provides a consistent rate of marking and tagging for Central Valley hatcheries, thus helping biologists track harvest rates in the ocean and inland fisheries. The data collected are returned to the Central Valley, The data collected are used to calculate the proportion of spawning hatchery and natural fish returning to the Central Valley, which affects season setting and harvest quotas in California's multi-million dollar commercial and sport salmon fisheries. At the Department of Fish and Game Nimbus Fish Hatchery in Rancho Cordova, more than 4 million young salmon called smolts are currently being tagged and marked. The work is expected to be finished this week. Salmon have already been marked and tagged at the Feather River, McCollumney, Nimbus, Coleman National Fish Hatcheries. Nimbus Hatchery is the last of the Central Valley hatcheries to complete the process. At its conclusion, the state will have met its goal of tagging and releasing 8 million tagged fish. Central Valley hatcheries release more than 32 million Fall Run Chinook salmon annually. And in our final story for tonight, Europe's frogs and snakes are in danger. There's a study that just came out in this story, written by Pete Harrison and edited by Angus McGess. One-fifth of Europe's reptiles and nearly a quarter of its amphibians are in danger because of the threat humans pose to their natural environment, according to a study carried out for the European Commission. The tortoise family, vipers, wall lizards such as the Tenerife speckled lizard and pond turtles are among those threatened, says the report from the International Union for the Conservation of Nature. Natural habitats across Europe are being squeezed by growing human populations, agricultural intensification, urban sprawl, and pollution. That is not good news for either amphibians or reptiles, said Dr. Helen Temple, co-author of The Red List. In highlighting Spain, Portugal, Italy, the Balkans, and the Mediterranean islands as some of the most important reptile habitats, Southern Europe is particularly rich in amphibians, but climate change and other threats are placing its freshwater habitats under severe stress, Temple said. About 42% of reptiles and 59% of amphibians are in decline, compared to 27% of mammals, the report found. The frog family, midwife toads, and fire-bellied toads are among those threatened, as are all three families of newts and salamanders. Shrinking habitat was the biggest threat to amphibians, affecting 17 of the 76 species, followed by pollution and invasive foreign species such as predatory fish and fungal diseases. And we thank Thomson Reuters News for that story. Well, that's it for the Earth First Update for this week. The Earth First Update is produced by Earth First Radio and is produced in the studios of Free Radio Santa Cruz. If you'd like to hear a podcast of this Earth First Update or previous Earth First Updates, I invite you to go to the following website, www.h2opodcast.com. That's www.h2opodcast.com. When you get there, click on Earth and then select Earth First Radio, and a number of Earth First Updates programs will be available for you to listen or to download or to subscribe to. And we thank the folks at H2O Podcast for recording and providing those archives for our listeners. Tune in again probably, well, I don't know. It's probably going to be a month before the next Earth First Update, because I'm going hiking. Yeah, I'm going to head out on the first of many trips this summer to the Sierra Nevada. So for the next 3 weeks, look for an alternate programmer who may or may not do an Earth First Update. Who knows? I'm still not exactly sure who's going to be doing these shows, but if you're a free radio programmer and you'd like to fill in with a music show on a Thursday night, give me a call or an email. You know how to reach me. Anyway,